Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special tribute episode today in honor of Sid Zimmon, who passed away on Valentine's Day at the age of 100 and a half. Over the years on Hometown Heroes, we've heard from men who flew just about every aircraft the United States had during World War II, but the role of the dive bomber was unique, and Sid Zimmon helped us understand what it was like to fly in SBDs.
The training for the pilot to be able to dive, and I'll explain the dive to you, and you can realize that the Marines would dive at an 85 to 90 degree and maybe a little bit more than that at a fixed target. We would fly no higher than 15,000 because you would burn more fuel, and we didn't have all the accoutrements, inflatable material that protects the present day pilot from pressure. The gunners would always face aft. Now, we were radio gunners, but I never once needed or was asked to change a frequency or do anything else. So we always faced aft to protect the pilot. That was our primary being there. When we were at Munda, until the Seabees, bless them, built facilities for us, they cut down the lumber, the trees, and they made literally screened-in facilities for us. It was really very nice. The only thing bad is they made foxholes for us. And Washing Machine Charlie, you would come over once in a while, a big Japanese, and the propellers weren't synchronized, so it would thump, thump, thump type of thing. So when Washing Machine Charlie came over, we would go out, and because the foxhole had about a foot of water in there, all of us were standing around the foxhole. And I remember one time I sat down on my helmet, and when I woke up, everyone else had disappeared, and I know I was embarrassed, even though I was all by myself, but picked up my helmet and carefully walked in, went back to bed.
And what about your time in the SBDs? One of the things that stood out to me in reading your memoirs was you described the very first time you're with your pilot, Akak Black, was that his name?
A.A., Albert Alfred Black, they called him Akak.
That the very first time when he started his dive, that you recited something. I don't know if all the other gunners were reciting, and this goes back to your Jewish roots.
It's interesting that you remember that. The expression is, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Didn't go into a big, long tirade, but I figured I should say something. If that's going to help me, why not? Mm-hmm. So getting back to the actual dive, we would, as we approach the target, it's imperative that you orient your dive. So when you pull out, you're heading for home. If you make a mistake and go inland, you have to turn around and expose to a lot of fire. Whether you make it or not is questionable. So at 12,000 feet, from 15,000 feet, we would pick up speed, orient a dive, and the pilot, as he pushed over into the dive, he would very quickly, and this is why it took almost a year to train dive bomber pilots, because this is not something you have to think about or write down, shall I do this or this or this? It has to be automatic. And so the pilot is a busy, busy guy. We're looking up at the heavens, and he very quickly opens his flaps. Now, the perforated flaps that were designed for the SBD were very, very critical to a dive bomber. And again, I say D-I-V-E, because if you keep your flaps closed, you would go too fast. If you open them, you go too slow. But with the perforations, all the flaps, upper and lower, had 2 or 2.5 inch holes. So by opening those flaps, arming the bomb, the pilot had twin 50s. He would get off a couple of blasts, had it precisely timed what he had to do, because from 12,000 feet at 276 miles an hour, an ideal pullout is 1,500 feet. You could survive at 1,000, but beyond that, there's no hope. You're drumming harps with the angels. And we're pulling about 5 Gs. And to this day, I can still remember vividly, when you pull out of, and this whole process took only 26 seconds. So the pilot was a busy guy. And I remember as we pulled out, gravity wants to pull a plane down. The pilot with power tries to pull up. And so there's vibration. And to this day, I can still remember my cheeks fluttering as we pulled out. Quite a sensation.
Well, you know, people pay big money to go on these roller coasters and feel some of these forces. Have you ever been on one that came anything close to what you felt in that SBD?
Oh, no, no. They wouldn't attempt that. In fact, they would, well, obviously, they would have to go thousands of feet in order to duplicate that. But I do, when I speak to the youngsters at the schools, the high schools and whatnot, I tell them that next time they're on a roller coaster, as you begin to go down, there's a split second where you have zero gravity. You can't even feel the seat, which lasts only half a second. Then, as it picks up speed, the next event occurs when you've hit the bottom and you're just barely starting to go up. You have to overcome gravity, and that's where the force of gravity is the greatest.
And you felt that times 100 in those SBDs and did it time after time after time. And I got the sense from reading your book, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that of all the places that you guys made those dives, the situation that you took the most pride or satisfaction in, or you see as the most significant, was a place that a lot of people, even if they've studied World War II, never hear about, because there wasn't a big land battle there, and that's Rabaul. I imagine that you make a point of educating people about Rabaul when you go and speak.
Yeah, Rabaul, the Germans were there for a number of years. It had a tremendous harbor. There were three active volcanoes. The last one in the late 1900s erupted. It was called the Mother and Two Daughters. I believe that the volcanoes were responsible for making a very, very large harbor, which could accommodate very, very large vessels. Simpson Harbor was the name of it. Now, Rabaul was famous for shipping copra around the world. Copra is dried coconut meat. Now, with all the plantations around, they had a process because a ship carrying a coconut with the shell and the water inside would not be able to be economically feasible. But by opening the coconut and drying the meat, it could be shipped all around the world, which is one of the things that occurred at Rabaul. Now, the Bismarck Archipelago, located just east of New Guinea, the lower tip of New Guinea is Port Moresby, which is the only thing the Australians had control of, and where they built up to seven runways, and where the initial attacks occurred. The Japanese, in January of 42, after they had finished with the Philippines and came all the way around China and Indonesia, the Philippines, New Guinea, Papua, stopped at Rabaul. Because Rabaul was so strategically located, it was there for the Japanese to protect all the islands, Gilberts, Marshalls, Marianas, and the others all the way up to Japan, including Iwo Jima and Okinawa. They had, I've heard, a million personnel there. Many of them they sent down to Guadalcanal, to Bougainville, which was the closest island, 200 miles, the biggest island of the group, and Guadalcanal was at the lower end, and they mostly had their troops stationed on the eastern side, expecting an invasion from that side. But we were smart enough to go on the western side, and at Empress Augusta Bay, around the middle of Bougainville in the Solomon Islands, they built a runway. We were ready to go a lot sooner, but when we finally left in September, we stopped at Upolu, British Samoa. There is American Samoa with Pango Pango, the harbor. Upolu is British Samoa with the harbors Apia. And that's where Robert Louis Stevenson wrote his novel, Rain. It was very, very picturesque, especially before we landed. But, you know, some of these little huts they had there selling whatever food they wanted. There was a skeleton of a ship I heard was a German vessel that sank there. And it was very, very picturesque. I remember, well, as a 19-year-old, Faleolo Field was really very picturesque. And I remember another incident, gasoline initially carried in cans. They were rather large cans, maybe 15 inches high and, 10 inches square. One guy, one native, had the can upside down, and two others would be with machetes in each hand, and he would beat out a rhythm, and they were squatting down, cutting the lawn. And it was really something that would be interesting for anyone to see in a picture.
What about what your squadron, in addition to other American forces, what about what you accomplished at Rabaul? When you look back at it now, why is that significant to you? And what were some of the things that you saw and did there?
The fact that it was such a tremendous stronghold and had to be restrained. And MacArthur did want to invade Rabaul, but Nimitz talked him out of it because it had so much armament and five landing fields and others on the northern side of New Britain. Now, the Bismarck Archipelago is comprised of New Britain and New Ireland. They had at the tip of southern tip of New Ireland was a lighthouse. Apparently, it was a radar station, even though radar in those days for the Japanese was pretty new. They could still tell that we were coming. The islands, so much of the time, you see when you look at this flight log, there is so much moisture with the islands surrounded by water that many times you couldn't see your target. And while high-level bombing, you can drop your bomb, but you cannot dive through a cloud. If you can't see your target, you can't dive. And so we would have targets of opportunity. If we saw a hut, we don't know who's in there, and hopefully it wasn't a native, but they didn't dive in the regular fashion. It was just more of a glide on the way back home. But you had to get rid of the bomb, because you can't carry the bomb home.
Well, you certainly couldn't land with it. It's time for our final break, but when this special tribute episode returns, how Sid Zimmon finally received his Distinguished Flying Cross more than a half century after World War II. If you'd like to see video of him throwing out the first pitch at a San Diego Padres game or describing some of his SBD adventures, head over to hometownheroesradio.com, where we also have a link to his extensive memoirs. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.